Welcome to the 258th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I am your host for today, Patrick Winograd. A little scheduling conflict here and there sometimes gets in our way, and that is the case today. But in this edition, our topics are an overview of my weekend predictions, a long overview of the NBA playoffs so far, and of course our weekly look at MLB as well. But let's jump right in with a look back at my weekend predictions, which are posted every Thursday on our website, 4thand24.com. Starting in the NBA, I went 3-1 in my NBA playoff predictions. And in MLB, I went 4-0 in those series-long predictions. So overall, I went 7-1 this week, which brings me to a 1,052-677 overall record. A 60.8 winning percentage, up just a little bit from last week, as much as it can be. But look, it's a pretty good week, obviously. I talked about how last week I was kind of shying away from just picking the team that I thought was better and starting to actually pick mostly based off of pitching matchups instead in MLB series, and I think that's worked out pretty well so far. I think normally I would have picked the Cubs to beat the Red Sox. They have a better record. I think they're a better team. And same thing with the Royals Tigers. But the way the pitching matchups lined up in those series, I picked kind of against the grain. And instead of going 2-2 by just picking the better team simply, I ended up going 4-0 because I picked off of pitching matchups more so than I did off the matchups. Although these were close series regardless. So I don't necessarily think it's entirely just that mentality shift. But look, we'll start with the Dodgers series. They took 2-3 from the Blue Jays. I thought it was a no-brainer there to pick the Dodgers. I mean, it's really hard to pick against the Dodgers in any situation, in any series, but especially with the way the matchups lined up in this one. But then I picked the Red Sox to take the series from the Cubs, which they did. That one's somewhat surprising because the Cubs have been playing better, especially recently, than the Red Sox have. Coming off a sweep against the Astros, I believe, earlier in the week, the Cubs were, but this wasn't the Astros. The Red Sox are better than the Astros this year, which is not a sentence I thought I'd be saying. But then, of course, in the third series that I predicted, it was the Braves taking on the Guardians, the best two teams in baseball heading into the weekend. The Braves took 2-3 in that series. That one, they were at home. I like the pitching matchups as well, so, you know, add both of those things together, and I think it's a really easy pick. Braves talent-wise are better, record-wise pretty much the same heading into the series, so that one was definitely an easy pick for me. But then, after that Braves-Guardians series, as I said, I did pick the Tigers to take 2-3 from the Royals, even though I think the Royals are a better team overall. But the Tigers did take 2-3 in that series, so I got a correct prediction out of that one, as the Tigers, like I said, took 2-3, which led to my 4-0 MLB record in total, all of those things considered. And then moving on to the NBA, I picked all game threes. One of those, I believe, was on Thursday, and the rest of them were on Friday. 76ers beat the Knicks 125-114. That was to make the series 2-1 to avoid going down 3-0. Big deal, I will say. Definitely very important to avoid being put on the precipice of a sweep. And then the Pacers beat the Bucks 121-118 in overtime. It was probably the best game of the playoffs so far. It was at least up there. I can't really think of anyone that are better off the top of my head. So I'll say it was that one for now, I guess. And then the Mavs beat the Clippers 101-90. This is, again, all in Game 3. The Clippers did come back and win Game 4, but we'll talk about that later. And then the Timberwolves beat the Suns 126-109. I didn't think the Suns were going to let themselves get swept, but they did, of course. So we'll talk about that more later. But that was the one prediction I did get wrong out of all those Game 3 predictions. And overall, like I said, 3-1, pretty good record. And I was pretty satisfied with my predictions this week, of course. A great record will always have me feeling pretty good about my predictions. But without further ado, let's move on to the NBA, where in the Western Conference playoffs, in the first round, the Thunder swept the Pelicans. This was kind of expected after the first game because the Pelicans didn't really look good at any point in this series. But started off in Game 2. Thunder won 124-92. In Game 3, the Thunder won 106-85. And in Game 4, the Thunder won 97-89. Before I go game by game, I would like to mention that 95, or 92 actually, sorry, was the highest scoring total of the Pelicans for the entire series. So they just couldn't get enough points on the board at any point to when they put up 92 in both of the first two games and then didn't even hit 90 in either of the games at home. So even with what you would expect to be better shooting at home, that didn't even happen for them. They just couldn't get anything going offensively. This is just not a playoff performance that that franchise will look too fondly upon, because it was just bad all around. Just a disappointing end to the season for them. Obviously, the Zion injury kind of deflated them, but no fight, really, that they showed at all in the series. Just no resistance whatsoever. On the Thunder side of things, at least to go on a more positive note, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander coming off his potential MVP season, playing pretty well, 24-10-3 in the final game after averaging 28-5-6 over the first three games of the series. So good series for him, a pretty good series for Jalen Williams as well. The Jalen Williams from Santa Clara, I should say. I guess you do have to mention that with this team. But he was averaging 26-7 coming into the final game of the series, and then he put up 24-8-4, excuse me, in that final game. So he had a great series as well. Those two definitely the main threats for the Thunder. Chet Holmgren had a pretty decent series. 16.8 rebounds, the average for him. Final game had 14 points, 9 rebounds, 5 assists, which was series high for him. But really, everybody pitched in for the Thunder. There wasn't a guy that you could talk about on that team that didn't contribute in some way to wins in the series, and that was really the advantage that they had over the Pelicans. Their stars showed up and played at least close to their levels, and then everybody else was there to supplant that, and or to support that, I should say. And then on the Pelican side of things, that just didn't really happen at all. You know, CJ McCollum averaged 17 per game in the series. That's below his season average of 20 per game, and that's even with Zion for most of the season. So those numbers go higher when Zion is out, of course. And he didn't pick up the slack without Zion in the series. And then you could say the same thing about Brandon Ingram. He arguably had the worst series. He averages 21 a game. And he had just 16.3 points per game in this series, ended the series with 8 points in the final game. And those numbers were actually going into that final game, so his numbers dropped even worse. He shot 40% from the field, or 42% from the field in the postseason, so just, you know, not a great series for him overall. He had one game where he was good in the first game, but he wasn't very assertive, in the second game. And in the third game, he was 5-10, 7-14 in those games. But, you know, if you're going to shoot 50%, you should be shooting a lot more than that. In the first game, he was 5-17, and in the last game, he was 2-14. So more shots are the same amount of shots in the games where he was terrible and just completely off than in the games where he played well. So I just don't get the approach from him at all, and I think that's been well documented. But look, Oklahoma City just didn't play anywhere, or sorry, New Orleans didn't play anywhere near OKC's level. Definitely did not deserve to win that series, and OKC is the one who walks away with the sweep as a result. And in the series between the 2 and the 7 seed in the West, of course, we had the Lakers and the Nuggets. This one, every single game close. The Lakers led in pretty much every single one of these games. Game 3, the Nuggets won 112-105. That one on the road, of course. But the other game in Game 4, the Lakers came back and won 119-108. That one at home to avoid the sweep. And then in Game 5, the Nuggets won 108-106 to advance to the second round. You know, it's kind of crazy as I'm looking at the Western Conference. There's only one series still going on, and we'll talk about why that is in a second, but this series was especially crazy. I mean, you know, Nikola Jokic did his thing in every game. AD and LeBron really showed up every single game for the Lakers. It's just a matter of the fact that Denver has a much better overall roster They're much more well-rounded than the Lakers are, and, you know, that's just something that the Lakers have to deal with. It's not exactly a great matchup for them. You know, LeBron had 27-8-6, 26-12-8, 26-9-6, 34-5, and they only won one of those games. So, you know, it's just not exactly a matchup that the Lakers will ever really be favored in. And then also he actually had 30-11-9 in the final game. And AD even played through an injury at the end of that game five. But, you know, Jamal Murray with his second buzzer beater of the series to allow the Nuggets to advance. It's really just the same story as last year, pretty much. A close series overall, much more close in actuality than it looks on paper when you look at the game, how many games were won by each team, but really close games throughout. The Lakers really fought in this series. I mean, especially that last game, game five, I said that, you know, might have been game of the postseason already when I was talking about the Bucks and the Pacers in my weekend predictions, but game five of the Lakers series was pretty close, and so was game two, both of those ending with Jamal Murray shots to win the game. Game two was a buzzer beater. Game five, a shot with about 4 seconds left. But look, the Lakers played really hard. They're just not a better team than Denver, and that's how it came out. That was reflected perfectly in the series. They're very, very evenly matched teams. But, you know, this is the problem with the Lakers. They dug themselves into a hole early on in the year. Golden State's not in the playoffs because they did that too. They didn't even make it at all, and the Lakers got a terrible matchup because they were in the play-in. So it is what it is. You have to play better in the regular season if you want to avoid playing the defending champs in the first round. And then you have Minnesota, who swept Phoenix. I think this was a shock to a lot of people. I know that, you know, Minnesota, I don't remember actually if I ended up picking Minnesota or picking Phoenix, honestly, on the podcast. I know I had that series going to seven and had it as being a very entertaining series, but I don't exactly remember who I picked, to be quite honest. But look, it was not that entertaining of a series, to be quite honest. The Timberwolves just dominated the series. First two games, the Suns didn't even score 100. The Timberwolves, throughout the series, scored 100 in every single game, scored above 105 in every single game. And their lowest scoring output was Game 2, where they won 105-93, but, you know, that's a comfortable lead. That's a comfortable win. They had an 11-0 run in the fourth quarter. Jaden McDaniels had 25 points in this game. That was kind of the big surprise performance. And the Sun Stars struggled. No one had more than 6 field goals made. No one had more than 20 points on their entire team. Meanwhile, every single starter on the Timberwolves had 12 points or more. And Nikhil Alexander-Walker had 10 points off the bench. This was really Phoenix's opportunity to win a game. Anthony Edwards had 15 points, 8 assists, 5 rebounds. That's not a great game by his standards. Karl Anthony Towns only took 7 shots because he was out with foul trouble for a lot of the game. So this was Phoenix's opportunity, and you knew that if they were going to come out like that in an off game from Ant, they just weren't going to win a game in the series. At least, you know, that's how I felt about it once I saw that performance. And that held true, as in Game 4, even though it went back to Phoenix, and that is the game that I picked the Suns to win. Anthony Edwards went off, 36 points after that rough game 2. Jaden McDaniels only had 5 points, but he didn't really need to do anything because Naz Reid had 13 points off the bench. Nikhil Alexander-Walker had 16 off the bench. And as I said, Ant had 36. Cat had 18 and 13, again, in limited minutes because of the foul trouble. And Ant had some choice words about that in the press conference if you want to look that up. But look, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, I think, in this series, you know, I don't think he went understated, but his impact can't be denied. He had double figures off the bench in every game except for in Game 4, which I'll talk about in a second. But, you know, they needed that kind of a lift in some of these games. I think, especially in that first game, he kind of electrified the team with his early scoring. And then he did the same thing in Game 2 as well, and in Game 3 had his highest point total of the series with those 16 points. Meanwhile, on the Sun side of things, Bradley Beal had 28, Booker had 23, Kevin Durant had 25, but no one else had more than 11 points. Royce O'Neal played 24 minutes, didn't score. You know, this is just a story again of a team having a poorly, not well-rounded roster. I mean, with the Lakers, it's, you know, I think the Lakers are more well-rounded than the Suns, honestly. They have better pieces around LeBron and AD than the Suns do around Durant, Beal, and Booker, obviously. But you know, that's the difference between having a big three and a big two. But still, this roster is just not well put together. Whatsoever, and it's showing right now when they really don't have cap space to fix that problem. And you know, that doesn't it doesn't help either that Grayson Allen got injured. I believe it was in this game, or no, it was in game two. He got injured in game two, so they didn't have him for either of the home games. That certainly hurt them a little bit. And then in game four, you know, they had a chance to defend their pride, not get swept, at least push it to a gentleman sweep. But after a rough first half, Anthony Edwards had 40 points. 46-9 was his final stat line. Cat finally didn't get in foul trouble. He ended up with 28-10. They didn't really need anybody to do anything off the bench, although they all played decent off the bench. Some poor shooting for Nikhil Alexander-Walker, but still a decent game for him overall. Jaden McDaniels had 18 points. Rudy Gobert only had 9 points, 5 rebounds, struggled with some foul trouble as well, but didn't really matter. Kevin Durant had 33 on 12 of 17 shooting. Devin Booker had 49 points, a playoff career high for him, on 20 of 21 from the free throw line and 13 of 21 from the field. But Beal only had 9. Outside of Booker and Durant, no one scored in double digits for the Suns. And again, that is just their depth. Sorry, the lack thereof, showing through. That's the reason why they've been underwhelming all season long. That's the reason they lost the series. I don't really have much more to say about them. That's just it's a poorly built team, and they know that. And I don't know exactly what they're going to do to fix that because they don't have first round picks, but they're gonna have to find somebody in the second round who can contribute immediately. Maybe draft one of the older guys that, you know, some of the younger teams and teams more oriented towards the future won't draft. You've got to get somebody who can contribute immediately though, because this is a win now roster and it's not winning currently. And then you have the Mavericks and the Clippers. This has been a really interesting series between Kawhi playing and then not playing. But look, regardless, the Mavs won game 2, 96 to 93. Very, very close game here. The Mavs trailed by one heading into the fourth quarter. Luka Doncic with 32, 9, and 6. Kyrie with 23, 3, and 6. Derek Jones Jr. had 10 points. PJ Washington had 18. And then on the Clippers side of things, Paul George had 22, Kawhi had 15, but didn't make a three. James Harden only made two threes all game, but had 22 points. It was a rough game, offensively, really, for both teams. But the Mavs did end up winning this one, and that meant that they technically stole home court for the rest of the series in terms of who has the advantage in the games won. And then they went back in game three and won game three at home. Kyrie Irving, 19 points in the second half, 21 only in the game, but those 19 in the second half were really, really helpful for them. Derek Lively with 13 points off the bench in only 15 minutes. Luka Doncic with 22, 9, and 10, his worst shooting game of the series, and yet they still won this game because their defense was great on the Clippers all night. They held the Clippers to 46% shooting. They did not rebound them either, but, you know, they got a lot of points from the free throw line, as the Mavs tend to do. And overall, they just kind of played a better game. I think the Clippers had a lot of turnovers in this game. They had 19 turnovers in this game compared to the Mavs only having 8. The Clippers actually had the advantage shooting and rebounding and from three and from the free throw line. So it was really just a matter of turnovers, but that was the Mavs defense stepping up. And then in game four, the Clippers blew a 31-point lead, as only the Clippers could, and then came back to win the game. James Harden with 33 points on 12 of 17 shooting. Paul George with 33 points on 11 of 19 shooting, including a three to basically ice the game near the end. Just a ridiculous shot from the corner. So there you go. The Clippers are 2-0 without Kawhi Leonard, 0-2 with him playing. Again, a weird dynamic there. I should mention Luka had a 29-point triple-double, and Kyrie Irving had 40 points in this game on 14 of 25 shooting. So the Mavs, they've hit their stride offensively in the series, I think, at this point. But they know what they're doing on the defensive end. The Clippers just couldn't miss in the first half. It's just going to come down to who can really scrape out these close games. This has been a really entertaining series. A lot lower scoring than I think I expected it to be, but still really entertaining overall. As we move now to the Eastern Conference, where Boston leads Miami 3-1. This is exactly what we expected. I mean, maybe not because we expected a sweep, you could argue. But overall, this is about what you expected from these two teams. Weirdly, the Celtics can't win at home. The Heat can't either. That has been a constant when these two teams have played each other in the playoffs recently. But look, game two, the Heat won 111-101 to make it 1-1 before heading back to Miami. The Heat knocked in 23 threes in this game. Franchise playoff record, near an overall NBA record. But despite Jaylen Brown's 33 points, despite Jason Tatum's 28 points, no real contributions for anywhere else. Porzingis went 1 of 9 from the field. Derek White had 13 points, but only took 8 shots to get that. And then everybody on the Heat was clicking. I mean, I said it with the threes. That was really the story of the game. And then in Game 3, Celtics shut down the Heat at the three-point line and did what everybody thought they would do throughout this series, just kind of dominated everything. They didn't even shoot that well. They shot just 30% from the three-point line themselves, but they held the Heat to 32%, and they kind of just have an advantage everywhere else, especially with Jimmy Butler out. And in the end, 104-84 was the final score of that game. And then in Game 4, the same thing happened. This time, though, it was Derek White who went off for the Celtics. He had 38 points on 15 of 26 shooting, hit 8 threes. If you just include everybody's numbers on the Celtics, they're 14 of 37 as a team. That's pretty good, 38% overall. That's exactly what you expect the Celtics to do. But if you take out Derek White from that equation, just 6 for 22, so not quite as good. But at the same time, they did have Derek White tonight, and that was the difference. Bam Adebayo had a great game, 25 points, 17 rebounds, 5 assists as well. Tyler Hero, 19 points, 4 rebounds, 4 assists, but no one else was in double figures except for Caleb Martin, who had 18 points for the Heat. So in the end, you get the Celtics taking it back to Boston with a chance to win the series in 5 at home. And then moving on to what has been, I guess, the most intriguing series, maybe not the most entertaining. It's been entertaining too. I mean, these games have been close, but, you know, I might put the Indiana series above it until last game. But without further ado, of course, I'm talking about the Sixers and the Knicks. They will have Game 5 in the series with New York having the chance to win the series later today. But right now, they are up 3-1 after they lost Game 3, 125-114. Again, talked about that in my predictions. Joel Embiid had 50 points in that game. Tyrese Maxey with 25, 7, and 4 as well. Kelly Oubre finally getting going, getting 15 points of his own. But it was Joel Embiid's game. Jalen Brunson had 39 points and 13 assists. He really needed a game to get him going, and that was a great sign for him. And that carried over into the Sunday game, Game 4. Jalen Brunson, Knicks playoff record, 47 points, 10 assists, 4 rebounds, 18 of 34 shooting. OG Anunoby had 16 points and 14 rebounds. He needed that kind of a game. Then you have Josh Hart, who didn't make a single shot, but still had 4 points, 5 assists, 17 rebounds in this game. The leading rebounder on either team. Joel Embiid had 27 points, 6 assists, 10 rebounds, but an off-shooting night for him. Same thing for Tyrese Maxey, who had 23 points, 6 assists, 6 rebounds, but also on 8 of 21 shooting. And in the end, the Knicks scraped out a really close, scrappy game, exactly how you would expect them to. And now they have the chance, like I said, to win the series at home in 5 games. This series might end a lot quicker than a lot of people thought it would, and the Knicks are looking a lot better than, honestly, even I thought they would. I picked them to win the series, but this is just another level that I didn't necessarily think they could hit, because they haven't even hit their offensive stride. Maybe they don't really have one, considering they don't have Julius Randle, but, you know, they can play better offensively. They can knock in some of the looks they're getting, and they're still up 3-1 in this series. So the Knicks definitely have another gear that they could hit, just haven't hit it yet. And then finally, well, not finally, because there are 2 series left, you have Indiana and Milwaukee. This one, I want to say it's been disappointing, but it hasn't been. The Bucks won game one, as we know, by 15, but then the Pacers turned around one game to 125 to 108. Pascal Siakam had 37 points, 11 rebounds, 6 assists, 16 of 23 from the floor for him. Just a ridiculous game. Tyrese Halliburton with 12 points, 12 assists. Struggled to get a shot going earlier on in the series, and we'll talk about that in a second, but Miles Turner, meanwhile, picking up the slack, 22 points, 3 threes of his own. Aaron Nesmith, 11 points, 7 assists, 5 rebounds. On the Bucks side of things, Damian Lillard had 34, 5, and 4. Brooke Lopez had 22 points. Bobby Portis had 14. Chris Middleton had 15. Just not exactly what you need from the Bucks offensively. They played okay, but they just couldn't keep up with the pace that the Pacers were playing at, no pun intended. And the Pacers also knocked in 44.4% of their threes and 55.6% of their shots from the field. And that is kind of the story of the series. The Bucks just can't play defense. This has been a thing all year long. It's why they brought Doc Rivers in to try to improve that defense. They have been better, but they haven't been better enough, I guess you could say. That's poorly stated, but they haven't made enough improvement on the defensive end. This team just does not guard well enough to win a series against an offense as potent as Indiana. They only won the first game because Indiana couldn't make a shot. And even in game three, this game went to overtime. Chris Middleton, with his heroics, forcing the game to go to overtime and then also tying the game up in overtime before Tyrese Halliburton's game-winning and one as a part of his 18-point, 16-assist, 10-rebound night, although he only shot 8 of 22 from the field and was 1 of 12 from 3. Miles Turner was honestly really the star of this game, in my opinion. 29 points, 9 rebounds for him, 4 of 10 from the three-point line. Had almost a third of the threes made for Indiana, which is just crazy considering that he didn't even shoot threes a few years ago. And then obviously Middleton, 42 points. Those three were really the story for either team. Dame kind of struggled, 6 of 20 from the field, 28 points, 8 assists. And then it was announced that Dame would be out in Game 4, and the Pacers very quickly took advantage after that off-shooting night, got back to their normal ways, hit 22 threes. Miles Turner was 7 of 9 from 3, had 29-9 for the second night in a row. Tyrese Halliburton got his shot back on track, 24-4-4 for him, and the Pacers won 126-113 to make it 3-1 in the series, of course, heading now back to Milwaukee, although it's looking like no Dame, no Giannis for that game later today. And then finally, you have the Magic and the Cavs. Home team has won every game in the series and has looked dominant, actually, in all games of the series. None of these games have ended up within single-digit margins at all. The losing team has not scored above 90 in a single game. The Cavs winning the first two at home, 97-83, 96-86, as we talked about last week. And then the Magic just coming out, just shooting so much better at home, 121-83 in Game 3, 112-89 in Game 4. Look, Donovan Mitchell hasn't gotten it going. In Game 4, he only had 18 points. In Game 3, he only had 13 points, so, you know, that's kind of where you look first on the Cleveland side of things. And then when you look at the Magic side of things, Paolo Banchero had his best game of the series in Game 3, 31 points, 14 rebounds, 5 assists. Jalen Suggs had 24 points on 9 of 11 shooting, and that was really the thing that woke the Magic up. It was his energy. And then off the bench, Markelle Fultz, Cole Anthony, 11 points, 10 points respectively. That's the performance you needed from the Magic. They felt the urgency, you could tell, and even though they were a young team, they had a good response. And then they continued it forward into Game 4. The Cavs only shot 23.5% from the three-point line, 4 of 17 as a team. Meanwhile, the Magic shot 46%, knocked in 12 threes. Franz Wagner with 34, 13, and 4 on 13 of 17 shooting. Paolo Banchero was only 4 of 14 in this game, and yet Orlando still won, which is crazy. Markelle Fultz with 12 points off the bench. Jonathan Isaac with 14 points off the bench. But it was really the Franz show for the Magic, and he was really, honestly, enough on his own to kind of propel the Magic to that win. And as a result, that series tied, going back to Cleveland for Game 5. But that is all I have for our NBA coverage for the week. We will move on now to a quick review of the MLB standings. We will start, as always, in the AL East, where the Yankees are tied with Baltimore atop the division. Yankees at 19-11, Baltimore at 18-10. Then behind them, you have Boston at 16-13, and then Toronto and Tampa Bay at 15-15 and 14-16. Those two teams with the negative run differentials. Boston, really good pitching staff performance so far this year, especially the starters. The bullpen has blown a few games and almost blew Sunday Night Baseball, if anybody was watching that, after a great Tanner Houck start. But at the same time, you know, this is a competitive team, and, you know, they were expected to finish last in this division. So they're happy that they're above 500 right now, even though their schedule has honestly been a little bit light to start the year. But the Yankees, getting it back on track after they had kind of a rough middle of last week, but they're getting back on track again. We'll see if they can keep that going. They do need to get more production from Aaron Judge offensively. Really, Juan Soto carrying this team right now. Juan Soto and the pitching staff. And also Alex Verdugo having a pretty good season. Then you have Baltimore at the top of this division. Most runs scored in the American League, second only to the Dodgers and the Diamondbacks overall. And then at the bottom of the division, like I said, speaking of the Dodgers, the Blue Jays lost a series to them over the weekend, but I really think this team is going to get better when they just start playing easier teams. I know this division is stacked, but they have played a pretty hard schedule to start the season, and that'll calm down soon, and they will get better as the year goes on as a result of that. And then Tampa Bay, don't really know what's wrong with them, just haven't really gotten off to the start they would like to. We know they're kind of a weaker offensive team as always, but the pitching staff is really the concern here because they've given up 148 runs in only 30 games. That's almost 5 runs per game, pretty much right on the dot. Just not what you expect from Tampa Bay, who normally has such a great pitching staff. But this year, things just not working out so far. And then you have the team with the best record in the American League. That is the Cleveland Guardians, that is the Cleveland Guardians. They are the singular Guardians team. But Cleveland, they are 19-9 on the season. They don't have the best record in Major League Baseball anymore because the Braves beat them in the weekend series and are now a half a game up on them for that. But they are still one of the few teams that haven't given up 100 runs as a pitching staff so far this year. No teams in the National League have done that. But it's only them, Kansas City, and Seattle in the American League who have given up fewer than 100 runs so far. That's really been the story for them. Their offense has been way above average as well, which is, I guess, somewhat of a surprise. They're not supposed to be this good offensively, probably supposed to be around league average and, you know, rely on a pitching staff just overperforming to get to the level they're at. But their offense has been not just average or above, it's been way, way above average so far, and their pitching staff has been extraordinary despite, you know, I mean, it's top three, top four-ish pitching staff in the league by stats right now, even though by talent you probably wouldn't make that argument at all. And then behind them, it's Detroit, who just won the weekend series against Kansas City. Their run differential, only plus three, but they have won two in a row. They're 6-4 in their last 10. And like I said, they beat Kansas City, who is 17-13, a respectable number for them. They have lost three in a row, 4-6 in their last 10. And then meanwhile, I mean, I don't know where this came from, but Minnesota has won 8 games in a row, 9-1 in their last 10, and now all of a sudden they're above 500. This division race is actually starting to get competitive, and then you look at the White Sox, and they're at the bottom of the division, of course, at 6-23. They're just horrible. But congrats to the top four teams in this division for being really competitive, and I would say way more competitive than really any of them were expecting to be heading into the season. You could argue the Twins are underachieving, but, I mean, 8 wins in a row is no small feat. So we'll see if they can keep that up going forward. Then you have the AL West, where the A's are somehow in third at 13-17. We'll talk about that in a second. But first, of course, Seattle in first place in this division. They are 16-13 on the season. They're 7-3 in their last 10. They had a few guys who were in some power droughts that recently broke out. Julio Rodriguez with his first home run of the season recently. I believe it was also Ty France that didn't have a home run for a while and finally hit one. But look, just overall, it doesn't really matter who was in home run droughts. We know Julio was, but look, this team has this team is a lot better than they've been playing so far this season. This should be a playoff team. I don't want to say easily, but they have a great pitching staff. And so far, fewest runs allowed in the league. It's just that their offense was so bad to start the year that it didn't really matter what the pitching staff did. But finally, they're getting some production offensively, and as a result, they're so much better as a team. Then you have the Rangers, who are 15-14. They're just kind of staying afloat. They kind of did this last year after their hot start, and then obviously picked it up at the end of the year, and then won the World Series. But I would, if I were them, I might want to start picking it up a little bit earlier this season, especially because they didn't have such a hot start, as they're still only barely above 500. So they won't have that to fall back on later in the year, of course. Then you have Oakland, like I said, somehow sitting here at 13-17. It looks respectable on paper, and then you realize they have the worst run differential in this division, and the White Sox are the only team with the worst run differential in the American leagues, and in all of baseball, it's just Colorado, Miami, and the White Sox are the worst run differential. I have no idea how they are staying afloat, but their record for now is okay. Then you have the Angels, who have allowed the most runs in the American League. Only the Rockies, which is to be expected, and the Marlins have allowed more in all of the major leagues. And then, weirdly, you have Houston at the bottom of this division at 9-19. Can't really tell you what their problem is. Justin Verlander has had two great starts since coming back from the IL. Their offense is not terrible, but it's not really that good either. It's probably somewhere around league average, maybe a little bit below. But this team just can't win games. I don't know exactly what it is. I haven't watched enough of them to be completely honest. It is still basketball season, of course, but the record is bad. The run differential is not horrible, but it does indicate that they should be below 500. Maybe not this much below 500, but at least a few games below. And then, of course, we can move on now to the National League, where the Braves are at 19-8, have the best record in baseball. Kind of what you expect at this point from this team. They did lose their last game, but obviously won the weekend series against the Guardians. So all is well in Atlanta. Second highest scoring output, or sorry, fourth highest scoring output in the National League. I mean, it's hard to quantify that, though, because the Dodgers and the Padres have played extra games over pretty much everybody, and Atlanta has only played 27 games, which is fewer than pretty much everybody else. But look, their offense is really, really good. We know this. They only have one less run than the Padres do, despite playing five fewer games. So they'll get there on a runs-per-game basis. They are better. And overall, this is a really good team. They're going to be a contender, as we already knew. And then behind them, you have Philly at 19-11, second best record actually in the entire National League, but of course, doesn't matter because they'll still be a wild card team because of Atlanta. 1.5 games back right now, 7-3 in their last 10. Then you have the Mets and the Nationals, who are both at 14-14. Mets with a +5 run differential, Nationals with a -5 run differential. But the Nats have won 4 in a row after losing their series to the Dodgers. But that sweep for the Nats was over the Marlins. It was a 4-game sweep of the Marlins. So maybe pump the brakes on the hype there because, of course, the Marlins have the worst record in Major League Baseball after being swept by the Nationals. They actually do have a worse record than the White Sox, excuse me, at 6-24. They have lost 7 in a row. And then moving on to the NL Central, it is the Cubs who are in first place in this division. They are 6-4 in their last 10 and took advantage of Milwaukee losing 3 in a row to squeak out a half-game advantage over the Brewers, despite the fact that the Cubs did lose that weekend series to the Red Sox, like I said. They came back, they won their first game of this week against the Mets, and obviously they swept the Astros last week as well. So a good showing for the Cubs recently, and they are in the lead, like I said. Milwaukee, though, not too far behind at 17-11, like I said, only a half game back. Then you have Cincinnati, 16-13, 2 games back, 6-4 in their last 10. Pittsburgh and St. Louis under 500 at 14-16 and 13-15. And finally, we will move on to the NL West, where for 1 week, if only for 1 week, the Dodgers did hit their stride. All it took was losing those first two games to the Mets and that series to the Nationals, but the Dodgers woke up. They won 10-0 last Sunday against the Mets. They continued that by sweeping the Nationals and taking the first two of a series against the Blue Jays. to mount a five-game winning streak where the Dodgers put up 10 runs or more three different times. So that's a pretty good sign for that offense. Excuse me, a six-game winning streak at a certain point. And then the Blue Jays did take the Sunday game of the series to avoid the sweep, but the Dodgers bounced back really quickly, scored eight runs against the Diamondbacks last night to win that game and take the first of that series against the team that isn't even in second place. Actually, second place is San Francisco at 14-15. Yeah, the NL West has been very, very underwhelming so far. 6-4 in their last 10 for San Francisco. The Padres are at 14-18. They have lost five in a row. Just bad from them. And then you have Arizona, like I said, still a better run differential than Philly, who has the second best record in the National League, a better run differential than every team in the Central, and only trailing the Dodgers and the Braves in run differential in all of the National League, and yet they are four games under 500. Couldn't really explain it to you. Their offense is great. They have the second most runs scored in all of the majors, only behind the Dodgers, and their pitching staff is not even terrible, I would say. I mean, they're definitely below average, but they're not awful, at least statistically so far. They're going to get better, though. Jordan Montgomery, obviously, just came back and will make that staff infinitely better and continues to do so in his first few starts. And then, of course, you have the Rockies at the bottom of this division. Not at the bottom of the league, of course, with Miami and Chicago still worse than them overall, but 7-21 on the season, 3-7 in their last 10. They've almost given up 200 runs already. They've given up 176 in just 28 games, which is a lot of runs given up. But that's all we have for the National League. And of course, that means that is all we have for this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, May 7th, where we will once again look back at my weekend predictions, have another look at the NBA playoffs, and have another weekly review of MLB action. In the meantime, be sure to check out my additional content, including my picks for next weekend's games that will be posted, as always, on Thursday, and my MLB Power Rankings, which will be posted tomorrow. All of that on our website, 4thand24.com. That's the number 4, THAND, the number 24.com. Thank you for listening.